Guess it's me now. All right. So, well, it's great to see all of you here today. Thanks so much for joining us on this beautiful day. What a gorgeous day to celebrate, to sing about peace and joy and just to remember who we are. The talk title this morning is, I don't know, A Community of Bodhisattvas, Part Deux. Okay? And you may notice that I spelled deux incorrectly. You know, in French it would be D-E-U-X. Odd that I would do that on a day when we actually have somebody who is French speaking briefly. And I consulted my prayer partner, Reverend Mark LaPonce, who is half French, and he gave me permission to spell deux, like deux, okay? So before I said, if you don't know what a bodhisattva is, I'm going to briefly explain what it is. A bodhisattva is a being, it's from the Buddhist tradition, and it's somebody who sacrifices to ensure that, postpones his or her own enlightenment or bliss or nirvana to ensure that others reach their own enlightenment, bliss, or nirvana. And I spoke about bodhisattvas last week, and we talked about the meaning, one of the meanings of the word sacrifice means to make sacred. So one of our versions of sacrifice is to acknowledge and accept and receive, sacrifice the inner voice that tells us we are not all that we can be, sacrifice that voice and receive the gifts of spirit that long to express through us uniquely, and then use those gifts in service of ourselves and others. That's what I would call a bodhisattva in some ways. And when we do that, I mentioned last week that sacrifice no longer feels like sacrifice in the old tradition, because it feels so good to serve others from our heart place, from the truest sense of ourself, that sacrifice becomes our bliss. Service becomes our bliss. And so that's what I'm holding forth for all of you right now, that we are all bodhisattvas in the making, all bodhisattvas evolving, and yet some of us may be, really? Are we really bodhisattvas in the making? You know, even the Dalai Lama, there's a story that I was told this week where somebody asked the Dalai Lama a question, and he said, is it okay for a bodhisattva to kill in the name of love? And the Dalai Lama said, well, you might want to ask a bodhisattva because I'm not sure if I am one yet. Now, if the Dalai Lama is unsure, but Brother Mark Nepo, who wrote that book that we're featuring this week, More Together Than Alone, he says that anytime we do an act of service, anytime we place aside our own ego and do an act of service for somebody, then we are a bodhisattva in that moment. So last week when Annette spoke about wrapping up cold people in blankets, that's being a bodhisattva. When we allow somebody to go in front of us in the line at the grocery store, that's being a bodhisattva. When we hold the door for somebody, when we bring a shopping cart back to its rightful place, that is being a bodhisattva. As you might be able to tell, Vaughn's is my ashram. I do a lot of spiritual practice at Vaughn's. So the reason for the duh in the talk title, lest you be wondering, lest it keep you awake tonight, is bodhisattva, duh, of course we are, right? Of course we are bodhisattvas evolving. And what I want for this community is that we all know that about ourselves and that we live from that place and that we raise each other up in greater and greater service and greater bliss. Wouldn't that be fun if we lifted this whole place like that balloon, if we floated to the top, and not literally, and we just were so filled with love and bliss that this became a shining beacon of light in Ventura. It already is to a certain extent, but even brighter, even brighter. Are you with me? Okay, good. All right, so we may wonder then, what are the characteristics of a bodhisattva that we can work on, that we can evolve within ourselves? One of the characteristics of a bodhisattva, I believe, is that bodhisattvas have a right relationship with reality. A right relationship with reality, with this thing that we call reality. I'd like to tell you a parable from the land of my dogs, Saraswati and Bartok. We call them Sarah and Barty for short. So normally I take my dogs on off-leash walks. I take them and I hike in the mountains of Ojai, but lately I've been trying to get them to do some nice gentle walks in our neighborhood. And I was out walking with them shortly after Christmas, and we walked by this lovely manger scene made out of stone. It was the Holy Family, Mary, Jesus, Joseph, a few shepherds, some kings. And Sarah, my dog, my girl dog, walked by it, stopped, stared at it, and then started baying at it. Not just barking, not just a tender woof woof, but a bay, like roof, 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 like that. Baying at the Holy Family. Now, what does this mean? Well, clearly, Sarah's not a Christian, okay? She does have a Hindu name, so I guess, I don't know. I've never known any Hindus to be at the Holy Family, and we bless all paths, but she's got to work on her acceptance of Christianity, evidently. What I think it means is that we are constantly creating a story in our mind. Just as Sarah created a story of that those stone figures of the Holy Family were somehow her enemies and going to hurt her, rise up and slap her, or steal her kibble, or whatever, we create a story about reality constantly. A story about conditions in the world, a story about other people in the world, a story about ourselves in the world. And then not only do we create this story, but then we bark at it. You know what I'm talking about, right? You can feel that? We bark at reality all the time. We argue with our version of reality. And if we're not arguing it, we allow it to scare us. We allow it to scare us, or allow it to cause us to run away, or to cause us to freeze, right? There's a great Ernest Holmes story. It's one of my favorite Ernest Holmes stories. It's in Living the Science of Mind. And he talks about how there was a man having a nightmare about monsters. And there was a monster at the foot of the man's bed, and he was a horrible monster. He was big and scary and awful, and he had an evil look on his face. And the man, cowering in his bed in the dream, said, "What are you going to do with me?" And the monster said, "I don't know. It's your dream. You decide." Right? So that's how we are with reality a lot. We're constantly asking reality or other people, what are you going to do? How are you going to hurt me? How are you going to offend me? What are you going to do? And then we act as if that truth is true, when that truth may not be true. That truth is most likely our projection in a large part. Okay? So what we can do as emerging bodhisattvas is to constantly check our relationship with reality, and to ensure that we are engaged in right relationship with reality. We can't ever really see the whole picture. Part of engaging in right relationship with reality means giving people the benefit of the doubt, much of the time, giving ourselves the benefit of the doubt. And also, it means when we're really fixed, you know, you can tell when you're really rigidly barking against something, when you're really railing at reality, your emotions come up. There's a lot of investment in it. You feel like this little shift in your mind as you start getting more sensitive to it. And if you're really invested in a story that you're telling and really believing it, I would recommend doing the Byron Katie practice of saying, is it true? And then if you say yes to that, are you absolutely sure that it's true? Because we don't see all of reality. We don't see the other person's perspective. We don't see the bigger picture of that this thing that feels like it might be against us might really be part of something that is for us, in a wonderful, miraculous way. And the way to allow it to become for us is to stop barking at it, allow it to be, and work with it in a peaceful and intentional manner. So another aspect of the bodhisattva. I think a bodhisattva has a right relationship with judgment. Judgment. Are you all familiar with that term? Okay. Judgment. When I was starting out in this teaching, I was in North Hollywood in the church there, back in the days of covered wagons. And and I remember the minister there at the time, Dr. Mark Vieira, he said that we had to be mindful of our thoughts because the day would come when people would be able to discern our thoughts just by being with us. And I hate to have to tell you this, but I think that that day has arrived, and it looks like Twitter. Lest I say more. I mean, need I say more, rather. You know, I read this article in the Times about this Twitter story where somebody ruined somebody's life because of some sexual thing they had done in high school, and then that woman was saying bad things about this guy, and then somebody else ruined the woman's life by saying that she had been a bully once in high school. You know, and it's just getting out of control. I read another thing about Meghan Markle, the princess, right? That's her. Well, she's Meghan somebody else now, but but Windsor, yeah, thank you, Windsor. That she people were just completely dissing her because she was holding her belly. She's pregnant, you know. Get a life, people. You know, get a life. Put all that energy into something else. Okay, where was I? Okay, oh yeah. yeah, a bodhisattva doesn't judge. Well, I guess I should just sit down and let somebody else take over. <Come on. laughs> Yeah. No. You know, okay, let's talk about criticism, which is a form of judgment, criticism. I was hiking with somebody the other day, and we were talking about forgiveness, and I was saying that the Course in Miracles says, that all forgiveness is self-forgiveness. And at that moment, I flipped it in my mind, and I said, if that's true, then perhaps all criticism is self-criticism. Yeah. And as soon as I said that, we were under trees, and my dogs were nowhere around, but a flock of quail flew out of the trees. And that felt like I look for signs and wonders all the time, you know, from my Southern Christian roots, and that was a sign and a wonder that I was onto something, that all criticism is actually self-criticism. All criticism? Really? I'm hearing a few, little hallelujahs, maybe. Yeah, you know, there's discernment and there's criticism, but criticism with condemnation, criticism with violence behind it, that to me is a place where a bodhisattva heart really needs to expand and do something different. Really needs to expand and see if there's a way to listen to that person's story and hear what they're saying and get some at least compassion and understanding about what they're doing and what they're saying. You can still have boundaries, you can still have rights, but it's so odd. I'm learning from this other course that I'm taking that as soon as you start listening to somebody's story, somebody's truth, and why they are the way they are, that things open up and the understanding starts to happen. And then subtly, they either change or I change and the world starts to look very different. The world starts to look very different when we step back and allow ourselves to receive to have compassion instead of criticize. The other thing about criticism that I have found very helpful, you know, this I feel like this is the secret of my spiritual evolution. It's the secret. I'm going to tell you the secret. And then I'll make a movie and I'll call it The Secret. Part deux. The secret of my whatever poise and equanimity I have around life is comedy, you know? It's just to recognize that life is hilarious. My husband Hugh told me that he knew I was going to be a minister years before I knew. He knew I was going to do some type of stand-up work. Because we were at a seminar and we all had to talk about something personal, and I chose to do mine as Mrs. Ed's wife. And so I was up there talking like a horse, saying, yeah, I resent it when people say I'm just horsing around. I guess that was a turning point for me. But anyway, comedy. Comedy. You know, does anybody listen to comedians on cable or listen to, like, I listen to it on satellite radio all the time, and they are constantly making fun of themselves. Constantly making fun of themselves. And so You know, I find that when I'm able to look at my flaws, which I do a lot because there are many of them, and I'm able to do a sermon about judgment and then start judging people, right? And to laugh at that and to have all you laugh at that with me, that opens up something wonderful. It opens up the truth that we are all here together in this beautiful mystery comedy called life. It's amazing. And then I start to see that these things that I thought were against me, that these are not my enemies, that these are counselors that feelingly persuade me what I am, that allow me to move into a place of self-love and self-compassion. So it's comedy, criticism to comedy, to compassion, to much greater confidence. Would you rather eliminate all your flaws? Would you rather affirm all of your flaws away? Or would you rather develop peace and joy and equanimity around any flaw that you might discover within yourself? Who wants option one, eliminating all your flaws away? Who chooses option two? Woohoo! Yeah. Because there will always be poor among us. There will always be that capacity of the human spirit to have ego, and what a blessing that is. You know, sometimes people ask me, why is there suffering in the world? And I ask them to imagine a world without compassion. Say, do you like compassion? Do you like feeling compassion for others, and do you like receiving compassion? And if there was no suffering in the world, there would be no reason for compassion. If there was no sorrow, joy would not be as joyful as it is. And so all of these things that we say against ourselves, or all of these people that seem to be against us, all of them, it's not like I have hordes of people who are against me, that's why I'm laughing, okay? All of these things that seem to be against us, again, these are things that open us up to be more of who we are, to be more of the bodhisattva heart that I know is beating in each and every single one of you, the bodhisattva heart that wants to welcome reality, the bodhisattva heart that has this right relationship with reality that doesn't need to bark at anything because it knows that everything is in its perfect place in its perfect time. That's what I know for each of us here today. That's the truth of all of us. Right? Good. Another beautiful thing about the bodhisattva heart, the evolution of a bodhisattva within us, is that a bodhisattva forgives. Some people ask me, or they say they can't forgive. There are those that say that forgiveness is not an act of will, but it is an act of grace and surrender. I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's will and grace. And you know what? I know. You know what? I'm going to make a sitcom, and I'm going to call it Will and Grace, part deux. No, it's will in that we put ourselves in the position to forgive, and it's grace that we allow something greater, something that forgives beyond our capacity to forgive through us. I have a beautiful example of how somebody was able to do that, to forgive in a big way. And that is coming through one of our beautiful congregants, Mrs. Annie Kohut. Yes. Let's give her some love.
The one next to you.
You can sit. Do you want me to stand? Yes, okay. You want me to hold your hand? Okay.
No, it's okay.
You want to get everybody up here?
Okay.
No. Okay.
Well, thank you for inviting me
it's
to share
pleasure.
My story.
It's my pleasure.
Okay. So, okay, I'll tell a little story about some experience I had during World War II in France as a child. So I was 2 years old when the Second World War began, and 7 years old living in a village in eastern France where I recalled some of my scariest times during the German occupation. My home, which was a spa hotel, was located a half a mile from an oil refinery which was being operated by the Germans, who used the oil for their tanks. We heard rumors for weeks that the refinery was very likely to be targeted for bombing by the Americans. We often sought refuge in our cellars whenever we heard planes flying low. It still moves me. Well, on August 4th, 1944, we were hit and hit hard when scores of planes started to bomb the refinery. And here I was, down in the cellar, being held tightly in my mother's arms. I will never forget her quivering voice asking me over and over if I could still breathe. All I wanted was for her to release me so I could escape from this scary place. All I wanted, Suddenly an eerie quiet surrounded us, and when we were in total darkness, as we crawled through the rubble toward a little bit of daylight in the distance, unsure what we would find outside. And then it was so good to encounter familiar faces of other survivors. We were all crying and laughing while hugging and embracing each other over and over. The refinery was completely destroyed, as were many of the houses in addition to my home, which was in a complete rubble. To our amazement, my school, as well as both the Catholic and Protestant Catholic churches, were still standing. And actually, in that little Protestant church, I was baptized, I was confirmed, and I married the love of my life. We continued living in fear of the Germans, where we were committing many atrocities around us. We hid in stables among the cows to keep warm in the winter of 1944. And this is when my other most memorable Second World War experience comes to mind. Again, as a child of seven, I could hear the whispering adults mention that the Americans would come and free us. After the long march through France, they finally arrived in our village. "The Americans are here. We are free," we all yelled. We could hear the rumbling of trucks as we crawled from our hideouts, jumping and running with joy. We kids ran behind tanks of the GIs, who were throwing us chewing gum, an item I had never seen before. They handed cans of corned beef to the overjoyed mothers. We were all free at last. With the help of the Marshall Plan, after 7 years, we were able to rebuild the hotel. By then, the refinery was operating again, and life was back to normal. 45 years later, as a token of gratitude and forgiveness, my uncle did something that I'm so proud of telling. Even without the aids of computers, he researched extensively and somehow found the names of the pilots who bombed the village. He invited 8 or 10 to visit us when they were wine and dined like royalty. To this day, he is still my hero. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. It's beautiful. Thank you. I had Annie tell that story because probably none of us know her uncle's name, right? He's probably not in the history books. Is he in the history books? No, he probably is not in the history books. He's a quote-unquote ordinary person, like all of us may never be in the history books, and all of us may be quote-unquote ordinary, yet completely extraordinary people. And one of the beautiful things that Charles Eisenstein says is that it is not important to be famous, it is not important to be extraordinary, because the world is going to change through the work of the ordinary people, of the everyday people, doing the work of opening our hearts, finding greater compassion, and greater forgiveness, and greater relationship with reality. So that's what I'd love you to take home with you today, is to understand that your role in all of this transformation that we're calling forth here in this spiritual center, that your role is significant. And all it takes is a little willingness to work on ourselves, to look at ourselves, to cultivate that beautiful right relationship with reality, to notice when we're being critical or judgmental, and to recognize that all criticism and judgment is self-criticism and self-judgment, to see if we can look within and come up with a better story, a story that encompasses all, a story that is more in alignment with spiritual truth, and then to practice the radical forgiveness that Annie's uncle practiced in France. This is what evolves the community of the Bodhisattva. Not only the individual community of the Bodhisattva within our heart, but the collective community here and the collective community of the world. Ernest Holmes said, "There is nothing to be healed, only wholeness to be revealed. And verily, I say unto you, there is nothing to be fixed, changed, or healed, only your inner Bodhisattva to be revealed." Let's do that now, and let us pray. Mm-hmm.